Okay. Let's make a start. Welcome everyone. My name is Mike Savage. I'm director of the IIII. And I'll be chairing today's talk, which is going to be a team effort with three speakers, Pat McGovern, Sandra Obdovich, and Martin Bauer. I'll let them decide how they're going to do it themselves. It's going to be a bit of an up and down show. You'll be speaking about 45, 50 minutes or so, I guess. Yep. And then half an hour or so for questions. So without further ado, I'll pass on to Pat.
Okay, yes. So thank you very much for coming along. I'm Pat. This is Martin, and this is Sandra. Martin and Sandra in the social psychology, the psychology and behavioral sciences department. I'm in the sociology department. I've known Martin for many years. He has interest in discourse analysis and public understanding of science. I'm a sociologist of work and migration. The IIII announced some grants, and we applied and were fortunate to get one. Allowed us to have Sandra work with us. It's a truly collaborative effort, and it has been a joy, actually. I've learned an awful lot about discourse analysis and in a world I didn't know before. So I'm going to introduce the project and what we're doing with it, and then Martin and Sandra are going to present the findings. So this is a pilot study, and we'll be certainly be very interested in any comments or thoughts you might have. Our starting point is a simple puzzle, that income inequality has increased since the 1980s across most of the OECD countries, across most of the 22 countries in the OECD, but attitudes haven't changed. I'm sure you're familiar with this, and if you went to Jonathan Meigs' talk last year, you'll be familiar with his work on the relative stability of attitudes towards inequality, income inequality, and redistribution. And our starting point is trying to understand why there hasn't been a greater public concern about this problem. We present it as a Tawney moment. So this is after R.H. Tawney, who was a professor of economic history here in the 30s and 40s. And just to paraphrase, a public discourse that recognizes inequality as a scandalous evil and names it as such. So our basic puzzle is trying to understand why we know so much more about income inequality and why that doesn't seem to have mobilized in the public discourse. There is academic analysis, and we've done some research on that with one slide on it. Which is about growing gaps, divisions in society, growing income differences across all levels. And that's on the societal level. And then in the economy, there is possibly the argument, which Tawney was challenging, that this is just an inevitable feature of market economies. That you have a set of beliefs and an ideology around this being something of a necessary evil, an unavoidable feature of the market. So our insight, our contribution to this is, why did the public lack a concern about it? Is it about a public misconception, a lack of information about the problem? And there is a growing body of information, of literature on how we don't understand our own situation in income inequality levels and so forth. And we see the mass media as a key source of information on the economy, aside from our personal experience. And the print media, we argue, remains important in shaping the political discourse. It's mediated by TV, and yes, I know we're going to say social media also plays a role in this, but we're heartened a little bit by some cold water thrown on the influence of social media last week by a report from Oxford with writers. And it's not an area where there's very much research. It's a curious overlap of income inequality and discourse analysis. But some work was done on this by Leslie McCall in the United States, and she covers the period 1980 to 2010 and argues that there is a media blind spot on this. It isn't taken up by the mass media, and certainly not taken up as a social problem. So we have a series of hypotheses about two aspects of it. One is the salience or the rise or the intensity of this issue in the print media, and the other is the way it's presented. How do we understand it? How is it presented to us? How do we understand it? And will this give us some insight into why the issue doesn't seem to have taken off? I'm very briefly going to touch on the methodology. we're covering the UK and the USA, but we don't find any great differences, and certainly not worth elaborating upon in the core of our presentation. We're covering these newspapers, Financial Times, Guardian, Economist in the UK, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and Forbes in the USA. So you see we're trying to have a mix of business press, liberal press, and business magazine. We use keywords from the Factiva and LexisNexis database. You see a list of them on the left. We've spent a lot of time going through and refining and generating a database. And in fact, we have four databases. I need to emphasize this point. So we're covering the period 1990 to 2015, so there's considerable overlap with Leslie McCall's work. But our largest database, original keyword searches, are just under 60,000 articles from these newspapers over this period. We have a smaller database, which is done using proximity analysis of keywords relating to income inequality. And then we have a much smaller, cleaner set of articles. And from this, we've taken out 240 for manual frame coding that we've used to create the frames that shape the analysis. Right, so that's just a general list. I'm not going to go through all of that. Yes, it is weighed to the overall number of articles in each of the publications and so forth. And I'm just going to hand over to Mark.
Okay, I kind of the first question we're kind of asking ourselves, what is the amount of attention that is given to this issue, which we all care about? I guess in this room we all care about inequality. How much attention is given outside? That's kind of a classic word I'm calling this salience. Am I just pressing the top here?
Right.
So kind of four issues. The issue might move from niche media to mainstream. That's a kind of an old idea about how social media make use of mass media. It's not social media, how social movements make use of mass media. In other words, mass media provide a kind of oxygen for social movements to mobilize, and this involves an issue moving from niche to mainstream, and this is what we might call then a kind of a turning moment. So we're looking at the intensity compared to some other intensities like global warming, which we know had a mobilization effect. I will briefly talk about a hype cycle on academic issues. Is this remaining a Brahmanic issue, not capturing the wider public imagination? And ultimately, or could it be that inequality is a bit like a popularization of science format? That's my world. I know a lot about popular science and how popularization of science creates issue cycles for a particular community. Let's have a look at this. So agenda setting, you're probably familiar with this. This is an old idea. It goes back to Gabriel Tarte, who late 19th century wondered why we're paying attention to a particular scandal and not to the war in North Africa. And he came back. This has a media effect. And this became standardized in the 1960s under agenda setting. The media are not telling us to tell us how to think, but what to think about. Okay. Or in a strong version, Mazur, who works in my era, science and technology, he's formulated the strong version: whenever there is a fuss about the topic, we start worrying about it. Okay. Think about global warming, we start worrying about that. Think about GM crops, we start worrying about it. The more you have. The more about you have about Lady D, we're not necessarily worrying about Lady D. Okay? But on science and technology, there seems to be this kind of strong effect. The more we hear about it, the more we talk about it, the more we worry about it. And what this basically, this is a kind of a measurement problem where you try to correlate the amount of coverage in the media attention in green, and this then corresponds to a relative importance of a topic. That's media agenda setting behind our thinking. The other one is coming an old story about how the ecological issue moved from niche concerns into the mainstream mass media. The question is how it moves from a kind of a niche to mainstream, and the argument would be initially in the mainstream it's picked up as unrelated issues about air pollution, about disappearance of birds, extinction, overpopulation, and then it strengthened itself by linking all these issues ideologically to something that's called ecology, and then ecology allows this to become a routine news. And the critical indicator of routine news is when all the newspapers had an environmental correspondent. And this kind of, you can trace this in a certain period in time where all the newspaper, all the media create this specialism that creates a routine news stream on a topic. That's kind of behind. And the argument would be this is how social movements create oxygen and use oxygen through the mainstream media. So anyway, our data, which Pat introduced, creates a number of indicators, number of research papers on income inequality from the Social Science Index, the intensity of coverage on this topic, keyword search, keyword hits, the absolute frequency of inequality references. But we need to consider that newspapers get smaller and thicker, so we need to take the amount of references, maybe in relation to the total news hole, which is the total amount of articles, and we create a relative frequency index, and then we might standardize this relative frequency index to 100 so that we get a good picture of how the trajectories work in different contexts. This is not surprising, the increase in inequality. Research papers, you're probably contributing to this, and noting it stops in 2016 for our research. That's where we kind of ended the data collection. But this is the story, the kind of raw data story you can see here. This is the Guardian on the right-hand scale, the number of hits per year in the full corpus. The number of hits in the Financial Times, sorry for the scaling, it's on a different side here. You can see the Guardian hits about 2,000, the Financial Times hits about 1,000 per year. The New York Times hits about 1,500 per year, and the Washington, what is it? The Wall Street Journal hits about 700. It gives you a sense of size here, okay? And then the curve is our relative indicator index, taking into account the total amount by the general increase in news hole. So not necessarily, you can see here, a general increase in coverage here does not necessarily lead in an increase in relative coverage. So for us important is this curve here that gives the relative salience for each newspaper. So we're trying to integrate this a little bit. You can see the interesting thing is there seemed to be a kind of an alarm in the early 90s, a little bit later, New York Times, and then peters out, takes off, or goes into the second phase, or doesn't go into the second phase. Let me give you a few comparators from my own research. I think that's why I got interested in this one. This is, for example, the global warming, climate change, the alarm, which we all got activated in the 2000s, and then this is the real peak here. And this goes up to, what is it, 4,000 references in a single newspaper per year. So that's on a different, the double or more of the lead we have here. This is the internet bubble of 2000. This goes up to about 7,000 per year. And this is the biotech. This is the famous GM food debate, the great food debate in the UK in 1999. Thinking about 1,500 per year. So it gives you kind of an idea where the inequality debate might be by pure counting the references. Conclusion would be the first conclusion with a peak around 1,500 to 2,000. We're probably close to something like the GM food debate in its high time of 1999 in the UK. Bon. This gives a little bit of an anchoring. Now let's have a look at these curves. I think we were fascinated by these curves because they have this kind of coincidence between the US and the UK, an initial hike, then goes down, and then it goes up. And we try to stylize this a little bit. So we're having in blue here, I think it's blue, which is the academic literature on nearly, what is this curve? Is it logarithmic? No, it's exponential. And you have this bimodal curve of public attention, the alarm on a low level, and then rising to 2015, and obviously curious will be how it continues ever since. So let's look at this bimodality of the curve. We have a kind of a level of around 30 on the index. Then it drops maybe to 15, and it goes up to about 60, doubling the earlier time, which gives us probably a reason to think about three phases in this debate: an early alarm phase, a quiet phase, and then here particularly post 2008 banking crisis, where the discussion seemed to take off. Now, what this reminded me, pure formally, of a hype cycle. Okay? It's a kind of a genre of communicating about new technology. When you want to create attention for a new technology, attract funders, and then see how it goes. And the hype, initially, in my world, is considered a negative term. You don't use hyperbole, which is a rhetorical form of exaggeration. Now, the hype cycle turned this into a virtue, a necessity. We need to have a hype cycle, otherwise nothing moves. Okay? That's why we're living through an artificial intelligent hype cycle and things like that. It creates attention, and it alerts particularly the financial world to possible profits for the future. So it looks a bit like this. A hype cycle is characterized by initial peak, then a trough, and an extension of the initial hype. So these are the kind of key characteristics. And it looks a bit like we have that here. I'm not sure whether you like this word hype cycle, but it looks to me that we have a similar phenomenon. We have an initial surge, we have uptake of academic research, and then possibly a second upsurge in a later stage. In my world, you can observe similar things on evolutionary psychology in the 1990s, a huge public discussion by very few authors in the newspapers, and then the PhDs and the research takes off into a new equilibrium. Similar things can be more archaic with paleogenetics, that's bringing the dinosaurs back and the hairy mammoth with genetics. Also a kind of public hype, but then the research stabilizes. Or an earlier version of this by historians with sexology. A similar Brahminic issue where you have an initial public debate and then the academic world stabilizes secondarily. In other words, popular science is often not coming after the event, it actually creates the event, the scientific event in the first instance. That's an interesting observation. So summary of this, on absolute intensity, we move probably from a weekly news to maybe a daily or a half-weekly news item over that period. How does it compare with an issue? It's less coverage than climate change and certainly less than the internet or artificial intelligence, but it might be something on the level of a GM crop debate in the late 1990s. However, income inequality may currently be at the level of, as I just said that. We have a salient structure. This is the model here, the Z model, that looks like a hype cycle, not yet gone into a second phase, an alarm in the early 90s, calming down period, and then rising coverage after 2008. And that's fairly the same in the US and in the UK. Now, interesting looking into the future is first bit of evidence. So if you split into two phases, pre-crisis, post-crisis, you see that the indications of a tawny moment, like scandal words, illness at hand, it's obscene and appalling, these kind of words become more frequent. So it might well be that the tawny moment is in the making, but it hasn't happened. Tawny moment is this idea to identify the evil and name it as such. That would be the argument. Bon, I think from that moment it's Sandra that takes over, is that right?
Yeah, I think so. I'm just going to pull down this here so that people can see a bit better.
You want me to do it on this one?
Hopefully that'll be useful. Great, so I'm going to talk to you about the second set of sort of my more micro-focused analysis that we did, which is looking at the media framing. So not just how much is it talked about, but how is it talked about? How is it discussed? How are the articles telling us to make sense of income inequality? Is it something bad? Is it something good? Can we fix it? Should we fix it? So what we did is we asked a few questions. So we had 240 articles from the small corpus. So the small corpus of 6,000 articles were articles that had the word income inequality in them. So it wasn't economic inequality or inequality in wages. It was purely income inequality that we were looking for when we were constructing that corpus. So none of the sort of related words. So we chose two sets of articles, 120, for two rounds of qualitative coding. The first one was to develop the codebook, and the second one was to sort of refine it and see whether it held when we sampled more articles. So the first question we were asking is, how is income inequality talked about, right? It's a fairly simple question that is quite hard to define when you're coding. But that was our starting point. The second was to ask, what's the temper or the temperature of income inequality? How is it discussed? Is something good? Is something bad? Is it neutral? It's just an article that's informing us about it. How is it conceptualized in the article? One of the things we wanted to see is there always one sort of reference point for how newspaper articles talk about income inequality? Is it always Gini, or is it always a sort of CEO worker comparison? Does this change over time? What actors are mentioned? So something that we look at in terms of framing is also sponsorship. Who is behind the frame and the sort of argument that's being put forward about income inequality? So we wanted to see, who are the actors mentioned? Is it activists? Is it organizations? Is it politicians? Is it economists? Who are the sort of people that are being named and why? And what type of argument is developed? So this comes from the framing literature looking at whether we have this thing called the full Monty, which is, it is described, it is analyzed, and there are solutions or sort of remedies that are being offered. Or do they only focus on describing the issue? Because if we want to think about it as an emerging social problem, we also want to think about whether it's conceptualized as such by being problematized and then with solutions being offered. So to give you an idea, these are the frames that we developed from the analysis. These all have dimensions, so we try to account for the fact that a frame can be used in a way that is positive or negative. It can be used in a way that makes income inequality seem as something inevitable or something that we can sort of deal with. So let me give you the example of the first one. So the first frame is all the articles that only focused on defining the concept. What is income inequality, right? And the dimensions we had was the sort of more extremes of defining it as the top-bottom comparison, the richest 5% versus the bottom 5, or top 10, bottom 10 CEOs, workers. Or was it something that was talked about in relation to more accessible examples, like family income, changes in family income, Gini, or on the national level? Type of change was when it was discussed in relation to where is it coming from and what kind of societal, historical, or political changes have brought it about. Here, one of the dimensions was this sort of neutral framing, that it's an outcome of changing factors such as women entering the workforce, migrant movements, globalization, versus a framing that was a bit more critical, but also at times positive, saying it's simply just an outcome of the fact that we have a skill bias towards technology now, and we need to reward the people that have those skills. Equality was about discussing equal opportunity versus outcome, and whether income inequality is simply something inevitable. If we give everyone equal opportunity, it doesn't necessarily mean that we should sort of counterweight whether people have different outcomes. The market one, which is probably the most unsurprising one, here we have the different dimensions relating to this idea that it's income inequality is a necessary evil of a flourishing market, of a capitalist market forces, versus those that were saying, actually, the extent to which we have income inequality in today's society is scandalous, and we cannot simply blame it on something inevitable and pretend like we can't fix it. Geographical level was looking at comparing it in a framework of global or national, where oftentimes arguments about rising income inequality would be countered by saying, well, on a global level, we actually have a decrease in income inequality. And when you look at migration and people, you know, sending money back to families, we're actually helping on a global level to create a more equal economy. Economic growth was a frame where there was this distinction between if we try to do something about income inequality by regulating the market, are we doing more damage than good? These articles tended to then, if it framed it as an issue about growth, and if we try to regulate economic growth, if we do more harm than good, then we shouldn't do anything about income inequality. It's better to do nothing than to do something that could potentially be harmful for the economy. Attribution level was looking at sort of who is being impacted by income inequality and where should we fix the problems. So this was in relation to sort of victim blaming. Poor people are poor because they make bad decisions, so we should just teach poor people to make better decisions, and that should fix this versus is this a structural problem that our institutions need to get involved in and actually need to be regulated in a better manner? And the last frame was a policy frame where income inequality was discussed in relation to its remedies. So how can we deal with it? And we looked at whether there were new policy remedies that were being suggested or offered or even imagined versus did it become subsumed under existing policy remedies such as maybe taxation or minimum wage. So just to show you an example, so on the attribution level, we have a sample from the Wall Street Journal where they say, given how deep the problem of poverty is, taking even more money from one citizen and handing it to another will only diminish one while doing very little to help the other. A better and more compassionate policy to fight income inequality would be helping the poor realize that the most important decision they can make is to stay in school, get married, and have children in that order. Now, I know someone could say here, well, you have policy in here, so why is this not a policy frame? There were a lot of overlap, obviously, as you probably imagine, between the frames, but we were looking at it in relation to what's the sort of punchline of the article, what's the end point of the article, and that is sort of what we saw as the frame in terms of how the story was being told. And you see here it's very much individualizing the problem, right? It's very much saying that this is something that we need to educate people to just stop being a bit stupid in how they make their decisions, and that should fix itself. Here is the distribution of our frames divided with the blue, the green line indicating the pre-crisis, so before 2008, and these indicating post-crisis. Now, as you'll see, there's a nice sort of shift in the frames over time, where the two dominant frames, pre-crisis, concept and type of change, are mainly focused on how should we understand what income inequality is? How do we measure it? How do we define it? How do we conceptualize it? And what are the roots of it? If it's something that is inevitable because of historic changes, what do we have any responsibility to deal with it? On the contrast, the post-crisis dominant frames are attribution level and policy making. So at what level should this be addressed? Where is the problem with individuals and their decisions or their choices or with the structures and systems? And this links nicely with the policy frame that also became more dominant in the post-crisis context. So you see these movements of the frames. Obviously, this is quite a small sample, but we thought it was quite interesting. What's also interesting to think about, the economic growth rarely changes. The frame is almost equally present across both time frames, showing that it's quite a dominant and sort of salient feature of how income inequality is discussed in media. When we look at temper, so this idea of how is it seen as good, bad, we see that it's quite unclear. It's neutral in most cases. It's explained and discussed and described, but it's not necessarily framed in a way where it's negative or positive. Negativity was sort of the second biggest category, but contested was also quite big. So this idea that an article would provide both pros and cons to anything in terms of do we deal with it, do we not, whose fault is it, where is the blame, and do we have a responsibility to address income inequality. When we look at type of argument, again, we see that the descriptive and the descriptive analytical were the most common, and less so this idea of treatment, this idea of what do we do about it. So where a lot of the articles would sort of explain, you know, income inequality has increased over the years, it is affecting a lot of people, it would end there. It wouldn't necessarily get into this idea of so what do we do about it, which might come into play in terms of thinking about why people aren't becoming mobilized, because where do we start with thinking about solutions? Lastly, here we have slants. So this we coded in relation to the political tone. We looked at what actors were being mentioned in relation to sort of the framing. So who are the sponsors and whether they had a particular political ideological leaning. So, for example, we see with attribution levels, so this idea of is it an individual or a structural problem, being more prominent in the pre-crisis, so this green line here, in the pre-crisis sample than in the post-crisis. And we see some distinctions here in terms of whether the tone, so the political or ideological tone of a framing changed after the crisis. Here we have a very messy graph on our actors. I should say that this was really difficult to code because of the fact that individual names could be named once or twice. Now you have quite big names in terms of politicians and economists at the time, which was really easy to code for. But at other times, it meant singling out individuals that were maybe mentioned once in 240 articles and then finding those in the 6,000. So our actor analysis was a combination of both individual names, but also sort of looking for the keywords in relation to economists, but also in the cases of the U.S. looking at whether Republican or Democrat was mentioned, because that's oftentimes identified when a politician is named. But we see here that there's initial sort of emphasis on economists, sort of the research that they're doing, and they're sort of the key voices of the issue. And towards the end of our time frame, there's a bit more of an equal distribution of both economists and politicians being brought into the conversation on the topic of income inequality. So, just to quickly summarize the findings from the salience and the framing. So with the salience, we see that it has increased over time, but not at the level that we would expect of mobilizing news if we compare it to other movements such as global warming or AI. It starts off and takes the form of a hype cycle, but stops at the alarm phase. We have this sort of sounding of an alarm. This is a big issue, but then it drops. And that sounding of the alarm doesn't necessarily spike or increase public attitudes or public awareness of income inequality. In relation to the framing, we don't really see any new frames emerge, but we see a shift over time from sort of conceptualizing and understanding to solutions and sort of remedies in policies. What we also see is that the issue often becomes anchored in existing frames and solutions. So how do we deal with income inequality? We look at minimum wage. We look at taxation. We look at it in relation to other policies that then take over and fragment income inequality from being one issue to being many other smaller ones. The temper and the tone of the discourse remains unclear and contested, which is probably also feeding into this. How should we understand this? Some people are saying it's not bad. Some people are saying it's good. Some people are saying if we do something about it, it might be even worse. Is it just something that, you know, is a necessary evil in this case? And we don't necessarily see any new actors emerge. We were also coding for organizations or sort of, if you're looking at the Occupy movement and things like that, like, are there any new actors that are being introduced in relation to this? And we found very, very little of that. And if they were introduced, they didn't go with the times and sort of remain relevant across the years. So I'm going to let Pat finish with our conclusion.
Thank you. Fantastic timing on our four-part presentation. So there's plenty of time for questions, which you'd appreciate. So this is a pilot study, and we have some thoughts about what we think is going on here based on our analysis, but we're also quite open to any suggestions from the floor. So we believe we have, in terms of the hype cycle as a device for understanding this, that yes, the academic discourse is rising. What this room does has been increasing exponentially over time. So like the environmental issue, the scientists are signaling there's global warming, there's something happening, we've identified this, and we're providing a lot of evidence on it. The question then is, how has the problem been sorted? How has it been taken up in the public discourse? Has it generated a new frame like economic injustice? That was one of our initial thoughts and searches for. And the answer is we didn't see a new frame like economic injustice. So compared to the ecology movement, there's no new actor emerging to cultivate the issue. We looked at trade unions, for instance, and we also started looking at religious groupings to see if some of those were taking it up. Mentions of trade unions increased slightly before and after 2008, but nothing dramatically. There's also the question of this very topic, income inequality. Compared to ecology, it's difficult to think of a visible disaster or some personalization of the issue because it's an abstract concept that can be presented in a media-friendly way, as Martin keeps telling us, with an example of the polar bear standing on the isolated slab of ice. We don't quite have that with income inequality. Very telling, we think, is that the solutions, when it comes to remedies in the frame, they collapse onto existing policy repertoires. And so when we say that, why does the dog not bark? The Sherlock Holmes story about dog not barking because the burglar was someone known to the dog. We think this is what's happening here. It's falling back onto existing, if you like, right-left policy solutions. Taxation, do we have more progressive taxation? Or do we introduce and raise the minimum wage, especially the debate in the United States? Part of that also, it's a speculative thought, is about the way it's conceptualized. If it's conceptualized as a top-bottom issue, then the articles are concerned with what do we do about the poor? We raise the minimum wage. And a small few, not as many as I was expecting or hoping, are talking about captain director salaries and so forth, dealing with the rich. That hasn't been a big issue, and much to my disappointment. And then there's the argument Jonathan Mees makes, which is that underlying meritocratic attitudes are still quite powerful. And that goes with the argument about, well, the market is working. It's an unfortunate side effect that we have rising income inequality, but that picks up on some notion of meritocracy. And so we think it remains a Brahminic issue. That is, it's one defined by and led by scholars, by academics, by researchers, originally applied economists outside of universities before academic economists got involved. And it's about essentially about popularizing research that we do. So I'll close this part here, and questions on any or all are welcome.
Thanks, that was a really terrific presentation, and really speaks very much to the kind of agenda we need to be thinking about in the AI, but how to move from the academic to the kind of more popular interest. Open it for questions. Can you say who you are, please? And then we'll take perhaps questions from parts two and three.
I'm John Hilkes from the Social Policy Department, and I apologise, I've got a few of the students shortly, so not in response to whatever you say. But your focus, your searches were all specific on the word inequality. And I wonder whether once you start using the word inequality, you are already, in a sense, framing it as a bit of a problem. Whereas actually the stuff about inequality the entire time, the FT has a whole magazine called How to Spend It. There's a whole load of stuff out there which is about the rewards of success, which is, obviously very hard to search for that, but there is, part of the meritocratic explanation is these are people just rewards. And that doesn't mean you don't then use the word inequality. You just say, Dyson has done fantastically well, or isn't Bezos great, or whatever. This just shows you what they've contributed to society. So there's a sort of a whole thing going on out there that's possibly even bigger. I don't know whether that goes up or down. I mean, whether there's a point where it gets embarrassing to say, look at these rewards of success, and then that does that at some point go down as a counterweight? I don't know.
Take a couple more, and then. Do you want to respond immediately?
Let's take a couple
more. Thanks
very much for a fascinating presentation. Just one, a couple of points. Look at some of the other research I've been doing on globalization and how it's portrayed. It seems to me, in a sense, globalization is the opposite, in a sense, of what you're looking for in terms of the fall in the middle there. This corresponds to the rise of the kind of support or belief that globalization is generally a good thing. But just in looking at how your analysis and your analogy to ecology, which I think is interesting, I'm not quite sure that the science or social science has as much weight as you give it in explaining these cycles, because I think it is, in a sense, itself more politically overdetermined and related to the general attitudes that are in the population. So I'm not sure that seeing that as the leading indicator of what's happening, necessarily the analogy quite works. The other thing is, I just wonder in terms of what you're looking at in terms of failure. One of the things we found in our work is that particular commentators had a lot more salience than general news coverage. So if you're looking for how opinion is changing, we've had what was sometimes called the commentariat was much more influential in shifting attitudes than just the average, of a news story, which, probably is more likely to be neutral. So I think that, you know, coupled with this, I think also the question of the attitudes of the journalists themselves, how they are, you know, who are their sources and how they're fed, I think is another important level of explanation. So I think, I mean, I think it's really important, but I think there are additional nuances that perhaps would strengthen this approach, and I think that's, you know, the argument that John makes really, I mean, for example, in the financial crisis, one of the big things that changed was the attitudes toward big business. So it wasn't necessarily, there was, you know, this inequality, but it was suddenly, you know, Fred the Shred was bad rather than good. And even in the popular press, which is another interesting thing that you don't include, there was a huge shift in attitudes to the rich, which didn't necessarily continue. But I think that's very much about the changed perception of inequality, how we view capitalists or successful people, just as, you know, what we think of as somewhat more abstract term. And that's, in a sense, where the personalization would come in. The personalization is not, is the personalization of the rich and where they sit and what they do, I think, more than a general income inequality, which, as you say, could be defined broadly or narrowly. So I think those are just interesting things I think might pick up, especially if you're doing further stages.
One more, my name's Cecilia.
Thank you for the paper. Mine is just really a quick corollary to what Donna just said. And I think the limit to the rich enjoying their wealth would be the discourse around philanthropy. And whether you might want to consider how that is looked at, because we know from research that that is how the elites justify their, well, it's one of the strategies through which they justify themselves. So that might have something to do with it, even though it's not called inequality.
Okay, who would like to reply? All of you.
I could do a little bit, and then I'll look to my colleagues for help. So on John's point, our focus is on income inequality, and it's not inequality generally, and that is because we were interested in the parallels with global warming, with Martin's research interest in parallel and public understanding of science, and that is how we approached it specifically, and that led our searching and our analysis of it. Sure, yes, there are all those other things going on. You know, you can read the back and the front of newspapers, you can read, but also we have to stop somewhere, because you can look at the popular press and you'll see celebrations of rich and successful people and so forth, and that's a great deal. Look at the nice cars and the staying in yachts. We were surprised in that we expected more of a shift in framing before and after 2008. That was one of my enthusiasms, Fred the Shred story, but that was about public taxation. And that seemed to be, we haven't looked at it, but that was my impression looking at it, because I went back and looked at some of the stories around the banker who walked away with whatever, several million from the Royal Bank of Scotland collapse. And that was more about at the expense of the taxpayer was being exploited, rather than a reaction about income inequality as such. That seemed to have come and gone. I don't know about the attitudes of journalists, but it may be, again, in the nature of this phenomenon, that it's not the sexiest topic to sell. So it's covered by the economic journalists and the business journalists, and they're fighting to present what is often mundane or dull stuff to the public, and they have to try and spice it up a little bit, and that may be why they go into top and bottom comparisons and so forth. So that may be some of it, but I think John is right to say that the very fact that we look at income inequality might suggest a particular kind of take in an area that is quite ideologically driven anyway. People recognize this. It's already there, and that's partly what we're up against, which is that there's no new framing. It goes back into our existing understanding of this. It's not a new topic in and of itself, like perhaps global warming seems to be.
Yeah.
Could I add something? John's point is something we probably have talked about it in the team, or thought about it a lot without using the right terms. Because kind of looking for the wider issue within which inequality might be embedded culturally. And that very much reminds me of the big trouble I have with my own research, to think about science rather than artificial intelligence. For the last 15 years, there's a huge development in content analysis, moving away from hand coding to text mining. But this sounds all exciting, but what you can't do is text mining. You can't really do the big issues. It's a nightmare to create a keyword set that captures the cultural issue, what you would refer to, how to spend the money, how to celebrate success. So it's very easy to go down a keyword. Okay? But then you still have to ask yourself, is the same keyword used for 20 years? You can't talk about biology in the biotechnology in the 1950s. That not exists. But you have to talk about genetics if you want to do it long term. So that's a changing. So that's a methodological nightmare. We quite thought hard about it. That's why our big corpus has 60,000 articles and references. We don't need to show that they're all about any corner. There may be interesting stuff in there. But we had to reduce it in order to kind of characterize the discourse. But it's interesting for us to know, and this is a pilot study. Part of it is actually carving out the methodology to deal with this issue. And to restrain and see how restrictive you have to be on the keyword. Single keyword is absolutely easy. You could do it in two nights. Single keyword often, but it's not adequate. It's a bit like looking for the light, for the key that is in the light, looking for the key lost under the lamp rather than where you lost it. So we have to be very careful in that sense. So that's an interesting reflection. So I think this is a methodological problem which we kind of struggled with a little bit and then kind of said, okay, we have to talk about inequality and reduce it in that way. But clearly, it would be an interesting challenge to widen this search. If we move from a pilot study to, and we want to scale it up, our first attempt has failed to get an interested funder for it, we clearly would, a variable, the genre would be an interesting variable. Is it in the opinion? Is it on the front page? Is it somewhere under business? This might be also something that moves over time, and the newspapers still have sections which reflect a little bit that kind of element. Okay? So I think that's clearly the genre of reportage is would be a more nuanced variable if we dive into this problem again. And what we wanted to do... Now, do I get all the...
Maybe I can answer that.
Yeah, please go ahead.
So one thing we did do was look at... we developed a dictionary about morality words to look at, you know, fair, just, things like that, to see whether that changed over time, because we thought maybe, you know, if it's framed in a way that it is, you know, it's fair and it's just and people do have a lot of money to do good things. So maybe we tapped into that a little bit in the morality keyword, but we didn't specifically look at it in relation to whether, like, it's justified on the basis of that they're also contributing back to society. The only places we saw that was in discussions around incoming migrants into the UK and the US who were actually sending money back, and so therefore they were helping their home countries and their economy of their sort of home countries, but only in that sense. But I think definitely if we do scale it up, then looking at the frames in relation to how income inequality is talked about, but not with the word income inequality, and how it's justified on the basis of merit, but also giving back, I think would be necessary. Yeah.
So I think that we have a number of tangential issues. So the philanthropic development, the attention to philanthropy could be another associate keyword, or how to spend it, cultural success. Mm-hmm. Also, cultural success is probably not the keyword to look for, but what would be the keywords or something like that. So I think that's an interesting way of broadening the capturing the discourse that, as a matter of fact, is full.
Okay,
thanks.
Do we have
some more questions?
Yep. I'm Chris. I'm a PhD student at the II. One question I had was just about the time frame that you looked at, and sort of specifically where you ended the study. Because it occurs to me 2015 is sort of an interesting place to end it, given that in both the US and the UK, sort of immediately after that period, you had these sort of two very popular left-wing movements
kind of alone on 2016.
Right.
Waking up twice.
And so the question is...
Three times.
Certainly it seems like, you know, if you think about the Bernie Sanders movement as sort of being framed around the millionaires and billionaires, that seems to be very explicitly about income inequality. And so I guess I was wondering why not move this sort of time frame up a little bit.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm Mary Alice, I'm a PhD student in social policy. I'm just wondering about your explanations, like numbers 2 and 3, and whether you have ideas of the types of policy solutions or actors that you'd expect to see emerging in the media commentary. I mean, I'm thinking that there could be things that seem like traditional public policy repertoire, but actually are quite different from what we have before, potentially, you know, really heritage taxation we talked about, or basic income, which I guess you can conceptualize as it being part of the tax system, but it's actually quite different from traditional public policy.
Thank you. Any one more? Yeah.
My name's Anne, and a non-academic member of the public. Something that occurred to me when I read this and that made me want to come was looking at something that seems to me to be history hidden in plain sight. And the comparison I would make is with something like the work that Nick Draper did at UCL with regards to the compensation for at the emancipation of enslavement. Globalization is not new, it's been going for centuries. Income inequality is about many people gaining income when many other people are working very, very hard and not getting commensurate income. And migration that we see today, in my mind, seems to be part of that whole melee. And I know it's not an academic way of looking at it, but I am wondering if there is something to do with changing the historical narrative that says, you know, this is a problem we have now. I think many people who are even teaching these kinds of things are not really aware of the historical thrust that says one or a few lots of people are getting an income that they themselves are not aware of what the sacrifices are for that income. And academic work in that area, of course it's to do with framing and getting the right slogan and timing and so on, but that's the thought in my mind.
Okay, who would like to reply?
So
2015.
Yes, it is possible there's something going on with Bernie Sanders and the left wing of the Democratic Party. It's also possible there's something going on with Brexit and people feeling they've been left behind, and perhaps that's a displaced reflection of the anger. But when we started the project, we were chapped by the time we started it, and we finished in 2015, 2016 with some of the data. So, if you know of any philanthropists, give us some more money, we can extend. Sorry, I don't mean to be entirely flippant. And there wasn't something parallel. Well, you have Corbynism in the UK, which was very explicit about income inequality. That doesn't seem to have caught on. Anyway.
But surely it would. That would appear.
That should,
in
it
papers,
should appear.
Right?
Yeah.
And more
yeah.
about. Yeah. You know, why would we expect this issue to be in papers before sort of political yeah. actors or other economic actors are putting it there? Right?
Like there is a trap with history here. Where do we stop? And so for this period, this is what we find. And we could continue for another 5 years. I mean, research is always 5 years behind what the public do. But yeah, no, your point is well made. We couldn't see any, because we'd have to look very carefully for any new policy measures. What we saw instead were the traditional things, taxation, progressive taxation, whether to change the bands and so forth, and minimum wage, or investment in education. And that brings me to another comment I'd make, which is that this discussion is largely dominated by economists and economics. And in terms of policy and analysis, the argument that was coming through was in the technology side was skill bias technological change. So greater returns to people who have higher, who have more education because they have more know-how in the information age, working on computers and so forth. And that, if you wanted a theory in this, is what comes out. And that's an individual story about policy is to invest in your education, which is in terms of attribution at the individual level, which is completely contrary to what you're implying. We didn't find that. It's perhaps simply a blind spot, and that might be about who dominates and leads this discourse in terms of the sciences, at least at the moment.
Yeah. No, go ahead.
I mean, you give us a good argument why we shouldn't stop and look for continued work. Okay? Because what happened after 2016 is anybody's interest. Okay? We also want to see whether it goes down or go up. In other words, whether things move in one direction. So I think that's a really good question. But on the analogy, so trying to compare here, you know, to learn something from the ecology movement. I think what's kind of lacking compared to the ecology movement as a social mobilization, first of all, the ecology movement had many cycles. I think one can count about four cycles. 1950s about water, and then Rachel Carson's giving the alarm on the birds not singing anymore, and then the population bomb, the late 60s, and then we're moving into the ozone hole, which actually was the alarm for the global event. So the alarm was before the atomic fallout of the 1950s, raised already the possibility of a global problem, but was ignored. And then the global warming, which we're now living as a main concern, came up in the 2000s. And I think a crucial element was that you had really visible disasters. You had in the 80s, you had the oil spills in Alaska and other places, Spain. You had Bhopal, you had Seveso, you had the Basel events where the Rhine was polluted with chemicals. So you have all these kind of large events which then coalesced these national concerns into an international concern. And the IPCC has specialized itself in maintaining the issue cycle with a five-year spill. So every 5 years, or I think that's the cycle, there is a big new report which guarantees coverage. So in that sense, there's a whole institutional behind. And also, it moves from social movement to institutionalized actors on a global scale, UN, a Rio summit, and so on. It's a totally different ballgame in that sense. But elements of that seem to be missing on inequality to make it into an actual issue. Also, ecology was for a long time neither left nor right. Neither left nor right could make sense of it. The right probably more than the left until the 1980s, I presume. Okay. That's, I think, on history. I mean, this is clearly not about history. This is what kind of part of historiography, that inequality as a reality is not picked up in public awareness. That is, I think, that's what the historical element.
No,
I'm
good,
thank you. Okay,
we've
got a couple of questions in the front here.
Yeah. Thanks very much for the presentation. I'm Alberto, a PhD student from government. I'm really interested in both media and inequality. So I have a lot of comments. I try to be very quick. So first of all, I think to some extent, in terms of the salience of the issue, it really makes a difference if the article is on the front page or in page 24. So you said that, but I think to some extent, precisely on the salience, that's really key. And then I understand that it's very difficult, related to John's point, to kind of distinguish whether a general article is about income inequality without explicitly saying that it's about income inequality, but maybe you can consider at least wealth inequality, because you can still have some sort of pattern over time. And finally, one way that you can explain that there is no turning moment, in a sense, is that also in the media there could be some sort of counter-argument arguing that inequality is not such an important issue. And of course it's very difficult to kind of, again, distinguish between the two, but even, for example, the quote that you show us is clearly something that is telling you, telling the reader at least, inequality is not that important, you know? People just, poor people just need to go to school and work hard and blah, blah. So, and I don't know, recently there was that title by The Economist, something like Inequality Illusions or something like this. So I guess when there is a spike in media attention, there could also be a kind of counter spike saying, okay, but what are we talking about, right? And to some extent, if you think about it, that's just almost really normal, because by definition, there are people that kind of benefit from inequality. So you would really expect that they try to influence the media, even if the attention is high, right?
Yeah, Jonathan Hopkins, Government Department. Yeah, this is really great stuff. I'm just wondering about this hype cycle, which I think I might have vaguely heard about, but don't really know or understand very well. It seems to me that, I mean, in part, this idea of initial peak, then the subsiding, gaining is helpful. But I can help thinking about it in terms of paradigm shifts, especially when Pat was just saying just now about how, you know, the way of addressing the problem is all within very, very well-established frameworks. There's no thinking outside of that. Well, what we're not thinking outside of is a paradigm of market liberalism, essentially, a sort of post-1990 view of how capitalism works. And naturally, the initial response is, oh, trickle-down isn't quite working as planned. There must be some little fix or nudge we can we can do to make it work. And we're just in this process, I think, now, where probably Piketty's book is the first sign of that, his first book, of actually starting to think, well, maybe there's a systemic, fundamental problem with how capitalism works here, and there's no fiddling around the edges that is going to make any difference. And I think, in terms of the way the academic debate goes and then public debate follows, that might be a helpful way of thinking about it. Because, of course, you know, echoing all the points made before about framing, the way in which you talk about inequality and what kind of problem it is going to shift over time as your understanding of what paradigm you're in and the problems that it creates, develops. So I don't know if that's very helpful, but
Suzanne, back
then. Thank you. Suzanne Wessendorf, IAI. Actually, it's similar to this last comment in terms of framing. So sort of, you know, the general message here is, for me, is like, what academics have found is fairly complex. There are different voices and stuff, and it comes, the issue, whole issue comes across as too complex to turn it into this one issue that everybody then will start panicking about, and then finally something gets done about it, like this global warming. And I'm just wondering whether you have any advice for people in this room, how we can talk about these issues in a way that it does then get picked up and is perceived as simple enough or understandable enough, not to sort of, you know, trickle away into the sand or however you want to call it, because it's too complex and all we can't think about it, you know, and it never gets picked up. Do you have any, do you know where we should be heading or how we should be talking about incoming inequality to make it?
Questions.
So I think this is why one of our starting points, I think, echoes sort of to all the points, was thinking about conceptualization, right? Because if it's being conceptualized in a way that's not accessible to people, then how can you make it an issue that you relate to in any way? And one thing that I found quite striking was that with the use of extremes to conceptualize it and anchor it, right? So this CEO worker, the top 5%, bottom 5%, most people can't relate to that in any way. But we see, for example, with research now on, you know, support for far-right movements or populist attitudes, they're driven in a lot of ways or triggered by a sense of relative deprivation. And it's relative, right? It's that I have less than others around me. Or with those, when it's in context of economic prosperity, it's the thought that I will lose what I have. The economic gains that I do have, I will lose them in the future. There's a threat to that, right? But if we can't frame it in a way where it's relative deprivation, but it's in such extremes that it becomes abstract deprivation, then people don't feel it as a personal cause. So for me, because most of my research is looking at intergroup dynamics and trying to understand sort of the us-them dynamics of any issue, I was surprised that there was no accessible us in the articles for people to say, oh, well, I can relate to that. I can, because most people reading aren't the top 5% or necessarily the bottom 5% when it comes to readers of Guardian, Wall Street Journal. It's the people maybe there in the middle. And for them, these are extremes that they cannot anchor into. And I think it relates to a point that McCall makes in her book and that we've sort of thought about as well, is that the rich are focused on the super rich. And you know, the poor are also focused on the super rich, and then everyone in the middle has no point of reference of where they sit. So I don't know if that in any way answers it. But for me, that was one of the things when we think about what psychologically mobilizes people, this fear of status, threat, and loss is really important when it comes to mobilizing for social issues. And that's not there in the data. So, yeah.
On the paradigm, I think that's an interesting observation. We avoided the N word here, neoliberalism. But indeed, this might be a kind of a long phase. I mean, I'm very fascinated by the idea that you can have different times within short and long term phases, and there's ultimately the concept of long waves of the economy as well, things like that. But it might well be that we are in the 25 years from 1990, we might just have one particular paradigm. And it is within that paradigm, there's a kind of a hype cycle struggling with the issue that we might hear called inequality. I think that's an interesting observation, the paradigm behind that. So in other words, there might be something to consider, a longer cycle of discourse about inequality. I mean, the measures are now going back to 1900. We might also be able to reconstruct the discourse since 1900 soon, with all this digital media and archives being available into the 17th century, some newspapers, 18th century, some newspapers. So that's a possibility to have a longer period to look at, which will complicate the methodology issue of what keyword to search. Okay? But that's an interesting observation. Thank you.
So on mobilization, so you're talking to a trade unionist here, and make a couple of observations. So that's obviously one. What organizations are out there who would be concerned with wages, wage inequality, wage bargaining? It would, of course, be trade unions. But they have fallen away dramatically, so we don't have media coverage of pay bargaining or who's gained 3% in the engineering industry or in the services sector or whatever. That's disappeared. And that's also something about our project, which is about liberal market economies. We're talking about the UK and the USA. We were intrigued, and this is something we wanted to do, is to look and see whether it's different under a different variety of capitalism, whether that discussion takes place in the public sphere about wages and so forth. Just on hope, there are some very successful small independent unions in London at the moment who use this very framing to embarrass high-profile organizations to give better wages and conditions to their cleaners. So that hasn't generated... It's generated a lot of attention on social media, but not so much in public discourse yet. But that is possibly one development that seems to be enduring longer than I thought it would, actually.
Okay, we've got time, I think, for one more batch of questions. Yeah.
Deepa Driver, University of Reading. In relation to the second point around personalisation, I was wondering, one of the things that struck me quite a lot in the recent general elections was around the personalisation of issues around homelessness, for example. And I wondered whether austerity and homelessness would be useful to add to this narrative. And picking up Pat's point about trade unions, one of the things that, for example, UCU has been tasked with doing is looking at a civic crimes commission in response to the austerity of the last 15 years. And I wondered whether that might be a useful source of funding to pick up in relation to this regarding your other
situation.
I'm Simon, doing my master's as part of the III. I was just wondering, in terms of framing income versus wealth, often in the media, in my exposure to kind of the way that they portray wealth and income, it's often like compounded. They'll often discuss wealth and talk about solutions to wealth that maybe impact on income. And I'm just wondering if by not including wealth inequality as part of the kind of search criteria, that maybe we're losing a lot of the whole conversation in terms of what the new discourse is around how to deal with inequality. And even though it might not necessarily be framed as income, maybe it relates to income more meaningfully in terms of how people are able to engage with it. And particularly I'm thinking around like housing. So often housing will be framed as a version of wealth, but maybe more meaningful to the middle class who might be like, well, I want to get on the housing ladder and be able to afford this. So I'm just wondering if that was a consideration.
Any one last question?
Thank you for the presentation. I'm a journalist. I have a strong feeling that this study takes for granted the assumption that traditional media in the 21st century shape or reflect public discourse, and that this discourse and that traditional media in one or two countries that you studied and in one language that you can focus on, they reflect what is happening in the world in some way. So could you please clarify the scope of this study and if this assumption about traditional media is correct and what can be done about changing, improving the methods?
Okay.
Just wanted to. Can you go to the methods slide with the keywords? So one of the things that we maybe should have mentioned is that we had these three data sets, and they were all based on different keywords. But the dictionaries that we developed from the qualitative analysis were then applied to all the data sets. So we sort of looked at.
If you just exit it, I think it'll be easier. There. Yeah, and then just scroll up. Okay.
Yeah, so just to sort of show that we did have wealth. Maybe you can't see it really well. What we did have, so the primary keywords were income inequality, inequality, salary inequality, wage inequality, economic inequality, income and inequality. So all of these words that we include, inequality or wealth distribution, they were all used for the large corpus. So we used a sort of small sample that focused on the word income inequality to see how is this being framed, and then do some of the dictionaries that we developed for that. So for example, the morality words, do they mirror onto the bigger data sets? So we didn't necessarily give you any of the medium or the large ones because we wanted to look at sort of the smaller samples and the framings. But that was one of the things that we wanted to do if we sort of scale it up a bit, is to develop these dictionaries, refine them a lot more from a sort of in-depth qualitative analysis, and then scale it up to the level to see can we find then these patterns in the 20,000 articles and even in the 60. But now I think it's probably good that we haven't done that properly yet, because there are a lot of things that we're getting suggestions on here in terms of how to refine it that would be good to develop these dictionaries further. So I think absolutely a lot of the things that are focused on income inequality does remove a lot of the things that people maybe think about or talk about when they think about income inequality, and that's not necessarily the words that they use. So yeah, absolutely.
Pat or Martin?
Pardon? Oh, the methodology. Can you just go to the... I think this is a question to be expected. Where are we here? I mean, yes, everybody talks about social media. My students only want to talk about social media. It's the only technology that exists anyway. They have no idea that nuclear power exists, but social media exists. So how can you talk about a newspaper? That's really mad. It might be to a certain extent. I mean, I think that's where, in principle, at the moment, a lot of people are spending a lot of time and effort on to find out what's the relationship between niche media and mainstream, and is there a function for the mainstream left? And according to Reuters last week, I haven't seen the whole report, but only an excerpt, for the last election, it seems to be that the big houses like the BBC and the Mail that really capture people's attention on the whole, and not small little niches. And in other words, they take a little bit of steam out of the enthusiasm of new technology. Now, this doesn't reflect the working condition of a journalist. Definitely not. I understand that. Because in the mainstream media is a total collapse of working conditions, a number of works, and funding. If you see the statistics of how advertising has collapsed over the last 20 years in the US, for newspapers, one wonders whether they exist in 5 years' time. Okay? But jobs have collapsed. But that's the question is really still out, whether this is going to be reinvented, because there's a key function for this, to focus attention in a polity, and not having a total fragmentation. But how the niche and the main is it a bit open for the moment? So why did we choose mass media? Because it's why did you choose legacy media, newspapers? It's a pilot study. You're trying to develop methodology. If you want to get into social media, you have to use different technologies these days. You have to be nearly Google, okay, to do it. So it becomes also very difficult for academics actually to work in that area. It becomes a different technology. So I suspect if we are scaling up, I would probably want to be a little bit more ambitious, but I'm not ambitious enough that I'm able to clarify the relationship between the niche and the main, and the survival of the main. But I hope the main survives, in one way or the other. So I'm not sure whether this is an answer to your question. But clearly it is a little bit looking at legacy rather than the new and the exciting. But the new and exciting is not always the most important.
And it wasn't there so much in the 1990s.
Also not, yeah, true. Mm-hmm. How to deal with the emergence of new technology, true, absolutely.
Okay, before we give our thanks to the speakers, can I just say next week's seminar, because we're going to have a seminar next week, not the usual fortnightly scheduling, very interesting seminar by Michael McCann, who's a professor at University of Washington in Seattle, on the theme of racial capitalism, resurgent populism, and the politics of right focus. So please do come along to that if you're free. And now, can we thank our three speakers?